Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go. Hour three is here. Thanks for listening. If you get a busy signal when you call 888-914-9149, just keep calling and we'll get you on the air as quickly as we can. Let's go to E. Frank now in New York. Hi, E. Frank. Hi, E. Frank. You're on the air. All right. E. Frank's not ready. Maybe you can get him sorted out. We'll go to Patricia now in Union City, California. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Patrick. Hope you're doing well today.
Thank you.
Hey. Well, my question today has to do with catechism. It's in my daughter's first year, so of course she's learning all the different prayers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And my question is regarding the teacher. She seems to have changed part of the Hail Mary, or added rather, to the Hail Mary. So the second part where it says, Mother Mary, sorry, I know it in Spanish. So I'm trying Mary. Really hard to say it in English. Holy Mary, Mother of God. She's inserted, and our mother.
Yeah.
It's Holy Mary, Mother of God, and our mother. So I wasn't really sure because I know when they get together with, you know, us old school people that learned it without our mother, they're going to get a little stumbled. Mm-hmm. So I want to just let it go, but also there is a nagging part of me that says, what else are they changing? Perhaps we should move her to another program.
And this is, what age group is your daughter in?
She's seven, so she's first grade.
So is this a parish, like a CCD program where the teacher is?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I've seen and heard of this stuff before. Typically, it's just kind of a good-hearted foolishness. This woman probably thinks she's doing something helpful, and so I don't question her motive. But it's gimmicky and unnecessary and foolish to do that. There's no need to tamper with these time-tested, honored prayers of the church, and she's not improving on it. She's detracting from it. You know, like the old saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So maybe one way to handle it is send her an email, or if you happen to talk to her, and just say, could you please not teach the kids this aberrant form of the prayer because it's not the way the church prays it and it's confusing. And I'd appreciate it if you could just teach the prayer. I mean, if you want to say the prayer that way yourself, that's great. But don't teach the children to pray it that way because that's not the way the church prays it. And we want them to learn the traditional way that the church prays it. They have a right to that without being confused. Now, maybe she'll say yes, maybe she won't. You could take it up with the pastor or, you know, whoever's in charge of the CCD program. I mean, I always hate to go in the direction of conflict, but sometimes it's not avoidable. Now, I'm not saying that this rises to the level where you have to have a confrontation. I'm not suggesting that. But you have a right to trust that your child is being formed properly without gimmicks and without the unnecessary goofy, you know, additions and things like that. So you're within your rights to protest it. And hopefully, maybe if the parish priest, if you ask him about this, he might gently let her know, please stop doing that. And maybe it'll stop. At the very least, though, if you have other options, I mean, maybe if your daughter could be moved into a different grade seven class with a different teacher, that's one solution. And the worst case scenario is, let's say there is no other class for her to go into. So you just let her know, honey, that's not the way to pray the Hail Mary. Here's the way to pray the Hail Mary. And if your teacher wants to pray it that way, that's up to her. But that's not how we pray it. That's not how the church prays it. That's not how the Pope prays it. So here's how we pray it. And you can always just deprogram this little bit of foolishness. Okay. You know what I'm saying?
She's still young enough that I can get her. Okay, good.
Right.
No, yeah, that's kind of, I'm very non-confrontational, so I didn't really know how to approach it. And we do pray with them, or with her. She's the oldest, so she can grasp it a little better than my other mm-hmm. littles. But we do pray, like, Our Father, Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. We teach her how to pray. I don't know the name in English. But we've been working with them to do some of those things.
No, that's good.
I just didn't know how to approach it.
I know. And it's, you know, it's a little bitty thing, but sometimes have you ever had like just a really small pebble in your shoe and you have to stop mm-hmm. and get it out because you can't, you know, it's distracting. Sometimes these little things like that can be magnified that way, but
right,
it'll work out.
Right. Okay. I think maybe I'll approach the CCT director rather mm-hmm. than the pastor, because we've gotten some questionable things from him in the past.
Okay. Yeah, maybe talk to the CCD director. But yeah.
Thank you so much, Patrick. That puts me at ease.
Okay. I'm glad, Patricia. Thank you. Have fun with the kiddos. Let's go to Charles now in Naperville, Illinois. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Patrick. I'm 83 years old, and I'd like to make a couple of comments regarding the atomic bomb discussion that you've been handling for a few days, which I've enjoyed hearing. Mm-hmm. First of all, being 83, I have some memories of World War II. I was 3 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. Mm. So I was aware of the war when I was growing up. I really didn't know much about it. But there was very little discussion about sympathy for the enemy at that time, Hitler and Japan. And when it was all over, now we have a lot of time to discuss the morality of it and so on, but I just look back on it, and the attitude at that time was just simply war is hell, and it was, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I'm very thankful, Patrick, and this is the purpose of my calling. I'm extremely thankful that the United States of America, a God-fearing country, discovered that bomb first. It could have been Hitler. It could have been Stalin. Mm-hmm. Then what would we be discussing today? That's my
right. And they were both working on it. They were racing us to try to get it done first.
You're correct. Yes, sir. And I just wanted to bring that point up along with our Monday morning quarterbacking today. Just throw that in so that we all know how fortunate we are that we're the ones that found it. And by the way, we only dropped two. And as I study it and hear it on documentaries, well, Truman probably would not have dropped the second one, but the Emperor of Japan refused to surrender. Mm-hmm. And his orders were to his armed forces, fight to the death. They were mm-hmm. going to... They were supposed to fight to the death, and some of them took that so seriously they didn't come out of hiding for years afterward.
Right. Yes, it sounds like you're a real student of history, Charles, and I admire that. I fancy that I am too, so I'm aware of what you're describing. But all of that notwithstanding, and I agree with you, I'm glad that the Manhattan Project got to an operational atomic bomb before Hitler or Stalin did. What a nightmare that would have been. But all of that notwithstanding, I maintain my position that the way in which we used the bomb was immoral. And to kind of reiterate what I was saying a moment ago, really, which is just a reiteration of what Pope John Paul II said and what St. Paul said in Romans chapter 6, is that we can never do something evil to accomplish a good goal. And it certainly was a good goal to end the war. And it was a good goal to seek a way to avoid further bloodshed, more people dead, Americans, Japanese, etc. But this means of doing that was, I think, clearly immoral because it was the direct intentional killing of 100,000 men, women, and children, not to mention those who were wounded and all the other things that accrued to it. So hindsight being 2020, as I look back on it, and as you look back on it, of course, you were alive then, and I wasn't. I was born 15 years after the war ended. But it doesn't change the fact that even if they weren't entirely sure what would be a good alternative, you know, where else could we drop it where we won't kill people, but we'll still convince the Japanese that it's futile to resist. And I don't know what all those possibilities were, but one thing I do know is that to intentionally kill innocent men, women, and children was the wrong decision, regardless of what the right decision might have been. That was the wrong decision, if you ask me.
Well, that's excellent, and I you just affirmed again why I listen to you almost every day, Patrick. I like to hear your analysis of things. You are wonderful. You have a wonderful program, as all the other hosts on Relevant Radio do, and I enjoy you very much.
Thank you very much. Charles, it says a lot of great about you that you have that ironic spirit, especially on issues where we might disagree. I admire that very much.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. Great talking to you. Let's see. Let's go now to Dan in, where is Dan? Silver Spring, Maryland. Hi, Dan.
Patrick, hello. I would take moral issue with your description that dropping the atomic bombs were an act of evil. I would protest and say just the opposite. They are an act of mercy. It, sometimes you have to take a life to save a life. And certain moral circumstances, human life becomes relative. Example,
you really believe
you
that?
Save, of course. You
really?
Save the mother's life. If the unborn human being is threatening the mother's life, you terminate the unborn life to save the mother.
Maybe you do, but I don't. Yeah, my view, Dan, my conviction
you wouldn't,
is...
You let me just say it. I'm not,
well, let me just say it, and you could disagree with me. My conviction is you can never do something evil to accomplish a good goal. It's a good goal to save the life of the mother, absolutely. But it's the wrong way of going about it by killing an innocent human being, the unborn baby, so that the mother can live. Both lives, the church says, should be, we should strive to save both lives. But to directly kill the unborn child and say, your life is not worth living, her life is worth living, that's just simply wrong. That's evil.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's a moral good to save the mother's life as opposed to the unborn's life. If the unborn is threatening the mother's life.
No, it's not. And it's not a moral good to take the unborn baby's life.
Really?
It's a moral evil, sure. I mean, you're killing somebody.
How is that a moral evil? To save the mother's life by terminating the pregnancy.
Well, because it's a moral evil because although the goal is good to save the mother's life, the way you go about trying to save the mother's life is immoral. It's evil because you're killing an innocent human person.
What is the church teaching on that?
I just said it. I mean, that is. I'm not being flippant. That's what I just said is that the church is really clear that, you know, when you're evaluating the morality of an act, and you have in mind a goal, and if the goal is a good goal, like saving the mother's life or ending the war or feeding the poor, that's good, but the goodness of the goal doesn't rehabilitate and make somehow good an act that is itself intrinsically evil. And taking the life of an innocent person, now this is an intentional direct taking of life of an innocent person, is always and everywhere evil. Thou shalt not kill. So we can never say that because the goal is good, that therefore I can do something evil to achieve that goal. That's always wrong.
Yeah, I think are you saying that the decision to save a mother's life by terminating a pregnancy is morally wrong? And
yes.
If so, you would do nothing?
No, I didn't say I would
better
do nothing.
For mother. Well, what is your position on a mother having a life-threatening pregnancy?
Well, my position would be that, now we can look at it in a couple ways. So I've talked before, Dan, about what's known as an ectopic pregnancy, early in the gestation process, where a fertilized ovum gets lodged in the fallopian tube. Now, if that's the kind of pregnancy you're talking about, the church says that you can perform, you can morally perform the operation that would remove the fallopian tube. And the goal of the operation is to remove the fallopian tube, which is now diseased and incapable of functioning, and the mother would die. That's moral for the doctor to do that, or for her to choose that, even though you know that an unintended consequence of that will be the death of the child, because the child is too young. It's not viable, can't survive outside the mother's body. So in that case, in that kind of a pregnancy where the act is not an abortion, the act is removing part of the mother's body, the church says that is morally permissible. On the other hand, if the analogy or the example you're giving is, let's go in and kill the baby because the mother's got extreme blood pressure or preeclampsia or there's some other life-threatening illness that the mother has, that's always immoral. And one thing that's very helpful, Dan, is the testimony of qualified medical doctors. I'm thinking of somebody like Dr. Anthony Levitino, and you can look him up on YouTube and see his talks that he's given. We've played snippets of them before on the program. He was on the faculty, I think, at Boston General Hospital. He was an OBGYN, still is. He used to perform abortions, and he says that there, in all of the thousands and thousands of cases of women in severe distress where they very likely could die, he said not even a single time was it ever necessary to perform an abortion to save the life of the mother. He said that in every single situation, you stabilize the mother, you perform a cesarean section, the baby is delivered, and then, of course, at that point, the baby will survive or not survive. But the fact is, he says it's never medically necessary to kill the unborn baby to save the life of the mother.
Well, I'm in total agreement with that. That's not what I was talking about. I was talking about what you described as a definite a death sentence for the mother if the baby comes to full term. That's what I was talking about. Not the second scenario you painted. I'm in full agreement with that. I'm strongly pro-life. This isn't a pro-choice argument I'm making at all.
But it becomes a pro-choice argument, if I may jump in here, if going back to the bomb, if you're saying, well, it's better that we kill all those people so that we, what, so that we don't, so that the war ends or so that more Americans don't die or to prevent further bloodshed, that's the point where I'm saying you have become pro-choice without realizing it, perhaps, because you're willing to compromise on that moral issue. And there's a direct parallel between the innocents that died in Hiroshima and the innocent child in the womb who dies because somebody decides these other lives are more important than your lives. And then we kill them to achieve a good goal. Whether it's abortion or bombing Hiroshima, either way, it's immoral.
Patrick, though, when the Jews send rockets to hostile fighters, they give warnings. No hostages, clear out the building. We're going to bomb you. We gave warnings. The Japanese were holding their people hostage. They could have surrendered.
None of this changes any of that.
We made that choice. We made that choice. We did not want to lose hundreds of thousands of American lives, which was very possible.
Yeah, see, Dan, that's the error or the fallacy of consequentialism, also known as proportionalism, where the calculus is if we do this bad thing, we're going to achieve some good goal and all these lives will be saved. I mean, that's condemned by the church, that notion.
What are you talking about, Patrick? It's not an act of evil. This is an act of war to save lives. Okay, these people were being held hostage. They could have surrendered.
But see, Dan, that's just window dressing. That doesn't change the actual
fact. Window dressing? Oh my God!
It is, Dan. Well, these are aspects of the circumstances that don't change the fact that directly, intentionally killing innocent people is still immoral, no matter how you slice it.
Objectively, it's an immoral act, okay? But to what end? There's, I believe in situational ethics, do you?
I can tell. No, I don't. Because Jesus doesn't.
Don't believe in situational ethics.
Absolutely not. In fact, the Bible condemns that notion. I quoted earlier where St. Paul says in Romans 3, verse 8, there are those who say, and maybe he had you in mind, Dan, there are those who say, and why not do evil that good may come? Their condemnation is just, St. Paul says. And the church, up to and including the Catechism, but even before that, Pope John Paul II, well, I guess technically after that, condemned that notion. That's consequentialism, proportionalism, and trying to evaluate the morality or immorality of the act on the basis of the outcome. What he says is that's part of it, but you can't neglect the part that the act itself, if it's immoral, it renders the action immoral, because even though there may be a good goal in mind, if you're doing something that is immoral, you can't do that. It's not my opinion. I'm sharing what the Bible says, what the church says, and you're free to accept it or not, but I mean, I'm not saying something that is just my own opinion.
If I was to tell a Nazi an objective lie that there's no Jews hiding in my basement, that's situational ethics. And you can say, well, that's an immoral act. That's an objective evil by lying.
Yeah, there are nuances to that question that would involve things like mental reservation and maybe expressing it in a way that, you know, the Nazis will interpret one way, but you mean it in another way. And if only we had more time, Dan, I'm overdue for a break. I wish you and I had a full hour just to talk the two of us.
We will agree to disagree on the premise of the dropping as an act of mercy.
No, it's not. It was immoral because it was directly killing innocent human life. And that's always and everywhere wrong. Thou shalt not kill. Hey, when you get a chance, Dan, you and I are still friends, but I'd ask you to think and pray about this. Read Romans chapter 3, verse 8. There are those who say, and why not do evil that good may come? Their condemnation is just. I think that's the answer to the question right there. But thanks for the call. Call me anytime, Dan. You have a standing invitation. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, let's get right back to the phones. We'll start with David in Tampa, Florida. Good morning, David, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Patrick, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
My question is about the principle of double effect, and it seems apropos to the calls we've heard earlier this morning, especially with the intended consequences of an act and consequences that are not calculated by the person committing objectively evil act. And I'll just refer you, Patrick, to the movie Master and Commander. There's a scene where Russell Crowe's character, he's the captain of a tall ship, a warship, and one of the sailors goes overboard, I think to do repairs or something, and it turns out the sailor who goes overboard becomes snagged on some lines, and the whole ship is going to be pulled in, and hundreds of sailors are going to die in the seas, and Russell Crowe's character, I think one of the other members of the ship have to cut the line and
commit an act to
free the ship. So I'll hang up and just listen to your comments about the principle of double effect and what the Catholic Church teaches on that. Thanks, Patrick.
Sure. Now, you don't have to hang up unless you want to. I mean, if you need to keep your hands on the wheel.
No, I'm still here.
Okay, that's good.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I just don't want you to feel like you have to. Okay, so that's a very good analogy. And I remember the movie. I've seen it several times. So let's work with that. So in this instance, the ship, the rigging, the sails, whatever, this guy gets tangled in that. And if it continues without the ropes being cut, the entire crew is in jeopardy. So let's analyze the act itself. The cutting of the ropes was intended to save the ship from dying or from, you know, sinking and everybody dying, but it was not intended to kill him. And this is where the principle of double effect could apply or would apply. In other words, his death, the sailor who was trapped in the rigging, his death was an unintended side effect. They weren't trying to kill him. They weren't saying, hey, let's kill that guy. This would be a very similar analogy to the ectopic pregnancy, where the fallopian tube is like the rigging, so to speak, and the goal is to remove the diseased fallopian tube to save the life of the mother, and the unintended side effect is the death of the fertilized ovum, the human being that is in there who can't survive outside of the womb. So they know going into the operation that this will result in the death of the child, but that's not the intention, and that's not what they're doing. They're not killing the child. They're performing the operation as a therapy for the woman. So in a case like that, the principle of double effect validly applies for the reasons I just mentioned. But it wouldn't validly apply if the, let's say that the guy's caught in the rigging of the ship and they harpoon him to put him out of his misery, let's say, or they shoot him in the head or something like that. That would be a direct killing of somebody. That would be immoral. So great example. I had never even thought about that, but that's a great example of the principle of double effect and why it's valid in a situation like that, but you can't invoke it in the case of killing an unborn child or innocent people in general as the direct action. Do you see the distinction between the two?
I do. Can you take that analytical framework and apply it to the nuclear bomb discussion? Because that's something I think a lot of people have a hard time with, but I don't think it can be reconciled under double effect. I just want to hear what your analysis is.
Oh, I agree. And that's really my project here, is to say that although the principle of double effect does apply validly in a case of an ectopic pregnancy or the example you gave, it doesn't apply validly in the case of using a nuclear or atomic weapon against a civilian population. That's my whole point, is that it's invalid in that application.
So if I were to play devil's advocate just for a second,
sure.
Now someone may say the dropping of a nuclear bomb or a weapon of mass destruction, that act was taken to prevent more deaths or to stop a war. Could that be a valid double effect?
Can you repeat that? I want to make sure I understand it.
Someone may argue, and I'm playing devil's advocate, that
yeah.
The dropping of the nuclear bomb or weapon of mass destruction intended consequences to stop the war or to stop more deaths, the millions of people who would need to have fought in Japan or whatever. Is that a valid double effect? I just want to hear your analysis on that.
Okay, sure. So we'll work the problem, or I'll show my work in doing the problem here. So in a case like that, I would say no. The principle of double effect does not apply, at least it doesn't apply validly here, because the intention of dropping the bomb on Hiroshima was a directly immoral act, because it was intended let me put it this way. The whole question about the goal is, how do we get Imperial Japan's attention, and how do we convince them that resistance is futile? So that was the goal, was we need to make them stop. And there were other calculations, like how many more people might die if we did a land invasion and so on. But the goal is, how do we get Imperial Japan's attention and make them stop fighting against us so we can finish this war? That's a good goal. But the whole point of dropping the bomb on the city was to show them, to horrify them, to see not only the physical destruction of the buildings, but also all of these people are dead now. All these kids, all these women, all these old people, all these people are now dead. And countless more are maimed and burned and are going to carry, we probably didn't even know the fullness of what would happen in terms of cancers and things. But that was the way that they chose to get the attention of the Imperial, government. So my calculus is that because it's an immoral act in itself to directly, intentionally kill innocent people, that made the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima immoral for that reason. It doesn't avoid or negate the truth that there were good goals in mind, but that way of trying to achieve the good goal was inherently immoral. I don't know if I'm showing my work adequately to show you how I arrive at that point. But this is why the principle of double effect does not apply in this case. I mean, it doesn't apply validly. People could invoke it, but it doesn't apply validly. Because in order for it to be valid, the act itself must not be intrinsically evil. And it's not intrinsically evil to remove a fallopian tube. It's not intrinsically evil to seek medical therapy for a life-threatening disease. That's different from intentionally killing the baby in the womb. And I'm just applying that same principle in the case of the atomic bombs. Does that make it clear, David?
Absolutely. And, I've come around on that atomic bomb issue. I agree with you 100%. But thank you for showing the work and full marks on that one, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, David. I appreciate it. Everybody, jot this verse down in your Bible, or jot it down on paper if you want to. Romans chapter 3, verse 8, don't forget this. This is St. Paul speaking. There are many who say, and why not do evil? The good may come. Their condemnation is just. So this is not a newfangled 21st century way of looking at things. This is straight out of the Holy Bible. And it's been the church's teaching all along, situational ethics. You know, in some cases, like the gentleman who called earlier about what do you do if the Nazis are banging on your door and they're asking door to door, are you hiding any Jews in the attic? You know, is it wrong to lie? Well, rigorists would say it's wrong to lie, but, you know, there is room for debate on this issue because it's not intrinsically evil to keep information from somebody who has no right to that information. That in itself is not intrinsically evil. And an argument could be made, I believe, that there are times and places where if it's an impossible situation and you don't have any way of a good outcome, to choose the lesser of those two evils is the better one. But that's different from intentionally killing somebody. So much to talk about here. Let's go to Donna in Douglas, Pennsylvania. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Patrick. I listen to your program every day, and we give. Okay. And my question is, you're saying that we shouldn't do evil for it to turn out good, but I always thought that God made stuff good out of evil. Can you please explain that better for me?
Yeah, so in other words, we can't do evil to achieve a good goal, but God can bring good out of the evil that we do. So both things are true, and that doesn't mean that because God can bring good out of evil things that we do, that therefore it's okay for us to do evil things. That's where the logic, I guess, is breaking down. Not that you're being illogical, but for some people who might look at it that way. So it is true. God can bring good out of evil. Romans chapter 8, verse 28 says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. Yeah. So that's his providence. And you might say his providence cleans up our messes, but it doesn't give us license to make the mess in the first place. We're not supposed to make the mess, but even though we do, God can still help clean that up. Do you see the distinction?
Yeah, so we have to leave it up to God. If we do something evil, leave it up to God to make it better.
Well, I mean, if it can be made better, it doesn't always happen that way. Yes, I mean, we have to recognize that God is sovereign, and God can, in his providence, he can bring good out of evil, as the Bible says. But all I'm saying here is that it doesn't therefore mean that it's okay to do something evil simply because God is going to, maybe, is going to clean it up. Is that helpful? Maybe we lost Jerry. I don't know. I hope that's helpful. Okay, let's take another break, and we'll dive right back into your calls right after this. Fascinating questions you're asking. I sure appreciate it. If you want to send me an email, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you press the contact button, and you could send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Be right back. You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. See how quickly the time goes by? Let's go to Jerry now in Minnesota. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I would just like to share with everybody what a beautiful gift that we have in our Catholic faith, the Sacrament of Reconciliation. Mm-hmm. 6 years ago, I waited in line to go. I was second from the front, but I pushed 30 people in front of me because I was afraid to go. I almost got up and walked out of church, and then I felt a hand on my right shoulder, mm-hmm. and it was like a weight that came down on me like I've never felt in my life before, and I looked and nobody was there. Mm. And so I can't explain it, but it happened. And when I went to confession that day, I confessed to my priest, and he was just laughing and giggling as I was confessing. And I looked at him, I go, "Why are you laughing at me?" And he said, "Because I'm just so excited that you're here. I'm so excited that you're seeking forgiveness. I'm so excited that you are healing by coming to me." It took a long time in my life to do this. I was filled with the fear of God not forgiving me and having the mercy to forgive me on my sins. I have grown since. I want to share with everybody, those who are struggling with inner peace and spirituality and their just their mentalness because of like, "Will God forgive me? Will God forgive me?" And mm-hmm. I'm here to tell you, He will. He will. And I am a testimony to that.
Amen.
I have an ADHD brain, and I fight with myself constantly. I can know I've been forgiven, but I don't forgive myself. And that's the biggest struggle I have. Mm-hmm. I know His mercy is endless. I know He carried me through the storms. I know that I've been told to put my sins into His wounds and sit there comfortably with Him, staring at His crucifix, knowing that that's why He died for us. Mm-hmm. And I just want to share with everybody, this is the perfect season to do this. If you are struggling and you think that you're alone, you're not. He is there with you. He is waiting for you. He never abandons you. And I share my experience with a lot of people. And sometimes they look at me like I'm nuts, but I say, I'm not nuts. I don't speak unless it's the truth.
Mm-hmm. That is wise advice that people gave you. And I can imagine how, you know, how overwhelming it can be to realize just how much God loves you and how deep His forgiveness is, His mercy is everlasting, as the Bible says. Well, God bless you, Jerry. Thanks for sharing that with us. Very encouraging. Let's go now to Cindy in Phoenix. Hi, Cindy.
Hello, Patrick. I just wanted to comment on the attitudes of people about World War II. Mm-hmm. And my mom was in high school then, and when we, I'm about 18 months older than you, so you know in the 60s it was brought up a lot about the bombs. And when I asked my mother, all she would say is it was necessary, they were mean people, they were, you know, torturing our people, it was necessary in the war. Mm-hmm. And that's basically all she knew. And she only knew this for decades, and I think the whole generation was that way because that's all our government told them. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later when the evidence started coming out about what happened, you know, the deaths, the amount of carnage, the cancers, and, you know, the testimonies, witness testimonies and all, that she started wondering, you know, the truth about it. But when for decades they only knew the one thing, it's hard for them to, you know, change what they believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm thinking as you're saying that, Cindy, about the Germans who they were aware of the death camps, let's say like Auschwitz and other places, but when the Allies liberated the death camps, they forced the people to go in there and see what was there. And for many of them, they had shielded themselves from this reality, maybe suspecting what was going on. But when they finally saw it and they saw the ravages of what were done to the Jews and others in the death camps, it just broke them. It just showed them, and they couldn't any longer rationalize it because mm-hmm. they could see it face to face. You know, for me, I always sort of had an appreciation, understanding of this issue. But when I first visited Hiroshima, and I've been there now, I think three separate times, for me, it was extremely eye-opening, to put it mildly, because, I mean, you see in the... There's a building left there. They call it the A-bomb dome, and it's directly below where the bomb exploded in the air. And they left it there as a reminder of just the terrible devastation. That's just on a physical building. But when you go through the museum and you see the artifacts and the pictures, and they preserved a step, is a concrete step. I think it was from a bank or a library or something like that. And you can see the shadow of where the person was seated and just vaporized by the blast. And all that's left of the person was the shadow that was imprinted on this step. It's there. You can see it and touch it. Walls where the ghostly silhouettes of women and children were flashed onto the wall where they were incinerated. And all that's left is just almost like a photographic negative of where these people were standing. Now, that may not sound like much for me to just describe it, but to actually go there and see it, it carries a real impact that, you know, can't be underestimated. So I'm not saying that I'm an expert, and I'm not claiming that because I went there somehow I have special knowledge. I'm not. Even if you had never been there, you could still arrive at the certain conclusion that you can never do something that's intentionally and intrinsically evil to accomplish a good goal. I know it's a mantra that we've been saying over and over again, but I'm happy to hear that your own mom, you know, that she came around.
All I'm saying is that they never knew the level of devastation.
That's true.
That was kept from them.
That's true. But now they do. Thanks, Cindy. I appreciate it very much. Let's go to Sam in Albuquerque now. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Patrick. I kind of wanted to join in on this conversation about the, mm-hmm. the dropping of the bombs.
Right.
So one angle that, and I don't know, and I apologize if you already talked about this angle, but I haven't been listening straight through the whole time I've been working on stuff. Mm-hmm. But so the Japanese army, as they were losing, the Japanese military, as they were losing, they basically enlisted a pretty good chunk of their civilians. I found an article here on NationalWorldWar2Museum.org where it's talking about how every single male age 15 to 60 and every female age 17 to 40 disinducted about a quarter or more of Japan's total population, about 18 to 20 million people. I don't know if it talks about it in this article or it was a different one that I read, but talks about how, you know, they just had this mentality of, you know, even if they were losing, they would fight to the mm-hmm. very last man.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs of exactly what that environment was like. That was, you know, I wasn't there, but I was also wondering if there's a parallel to, you know, some of these, the countries in the Middle East where we've been in conflicts. I watched a movie, I believe it was based.
Sam, I don't have time for that. Could you summarize your question? Because we're running out of time.
Well, if, you know, given that fact that they're basically making their civilians militia and that there was no distinction between the civilians and the militia, and also you've got, you know, these families that are committing suicide after certain towns are captured, and I don't know if it'd be a situation where, you know, the children, you know, even kids, you know, 7 to 10 years old would be and younger, basically trying to kill soldiers, you know. And
right. Let me jump in, Sam, just because we're getting close to the end. I understand what you're saying, but it doesn't mitigate the problem because, number one, when the bomb was dropped, all those people in Hiroshima were not killing anybody. maybe legally they had been conscripted by the government, or at least some of them had, but they weren't, first of all, they were not necessarily doing this freely. But even if they were, they weren't in the act of killing anybody, because there were no Allied soldiers there. There were no Americans, certainly. There was nobody that they were actually killing. So that, too, would fall into the category of a future calculation. You know, what might have happened in the future if this or that hadn't been done? We have to do that. But what Pope John Paul II said so clearly and forcefully is that those calculations, which are ultimately impossible to really know for sure what will happen, we can only speculate. But all of those speculations and calculations don't change. It can't make an immoral act moral somehow. It can't turn this into something that's okay under these circumstances. Now, I wish there were more time, but I'll have to leave it at that. I think I answered your question, Sam. I hope I did. Thank you. Let's go now to, let's see, let's go to Bill in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill.
Yes, hi, Patrick. My question is how you reconcile the doctrine of self-defense, especially in war, mm-hmm. with what you've been saying about the nuclear bomb.
Okay, I would reconcile it this way by saying that you not only in war, but you as an individual and the corporate individual, you know, a country, let's say, you have the right to defend yourself, and you have the right to use lethal force if it's necessary and proportionate to the threat that is coming against you. But you have the right to use that on the aggressor, not on innocent third parties. So self-defense ends when you're attacking somebody who's not attacking you. So let's say that there's somebody who's constantly attacking you, and you go to his house and you kill him, and then you kill his wife and all of his kids too. That's murder. Now, maybe it's not an exact analogy, because self-defense, typically the person's coming into your house. But if, let's say, he's in your front yard and his wife and children are off to the side and he's got a knife and he's trying to kill you, you have a right to defend yourself, and maybe you kill him in the process of defending yourself, but you can't turn the gun on his wife and children and kill them too.
Well, I understand that, but, you know, mm-hmm. in World War II, there was all kinds of bombing and atrocities that were committed mm-hmm. almost daily as part of the war. I mean, war is a horrible thing.
Yeah.
And it's terrible that any of those things occurred. But where do you draw the line in war? The nuclear bomb was horrible, but there were all kinds of horrible things going on.
Well, the old saying, two wrongs don't make a right. So we don't arrive at a certitude of whether an action is moral or not moral on the basis of what other immoral things are going on. So the fact that war is hell and people are doing terrible things doesn't give you the right to do something that's immoral just because other people are doing immoral things.
No, but then you're saying you cannot prosecute a war?
No, but you have to be more judicious about how you do it. And I mean, the whole question, it seems, turns upon the moral question: is it okay to incinerate 100,000 innocent men, women, and children so that we can get Japan's attention and make them stop? And my conviction is that it was immoral to do that.
I understand that conviction. I may agree with it, but I also see that there's no good coming out of war in any of
that's
the
for
actions
sure.
happen.
That's for sure, Bill. I can agree with you on that. I think we can all agree on that, right? Well, thank you. Thanks to all of you. I look forward to being with you again very soon. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.